Hello, buddy. Welcome to the Boxing Science Podcast. This is another Q&A episode, but this time I'm joined by Dr. Alan Ruddock, answering your questions around a range of different subjects. Strength training to complex training, conditioning a boxer, talking about 30-second maximal sprints, and also talking about recovery methods, and most importantly, how recovery methods can be adapted to people and athletes with low budgets. If you're wanting us to answer your questions around training for boxing, please leave them in the comment box below. Hopefully you enjoy the video. At what stage should I do strength training? And what stage should I start building explosive strength training and power? So this is a question that we receive quite often at Boxing Science in many different formats around how to program strength and conditioning over 8, 10 or 12 week block. Now, to keep it very, very simple, there's a lot of individual situations from advanced athletes to foundational athletes to 8 week camps to 12 week camps. So there's not one size fits all, but a general rule of thumb, and to keep things really simple, we start doing strength and maximum strength at the start of camp. So from 12 weeks out through to around about 6 weeks out. From 6 weeks out, that's when we start working more dynamically, working on strength, speed and explosiveness, and eventually going towards maximum speed and that transfer towards a punch. Now, the main reason why is because we use this term called residual effects. So this means the amount of days that you can go without training a strength quality or fitness quality without reducing the performance in that. What the research shows is that strength training has around about 30 days. It depends on the individual, their strength levels and everything like that, but it's around about 30 days. So we know from about 4 to 6 weeks out, we can drop the strength training, start working on kind of strength, speed and explosiveness without having an effect on the strength levels going towards fight night. Whereas like maximum speed has around about 5 days. So that's a lot shorter window. So that means that we're taking speed all the way through towards fight night. So that's the importance of our taper phase when we're doing really light and explosive work, taking it into fight night and making sure that we're at peak physical performance when we're stepping into the ring. To answer your question, explosive training starts around about 6 weeks out. Now, if you're wanting help with this, we've got a brand new program, Ultimate Speed and Power Program, where you can just slot this in into your training program. So you can be working on maximum strength or strength endurance or whatever your training plan is. You can pop this program in 6 weeks where we're looking at transferring them strength qualities into explosive performance. It's an easy to follow program. It's adaptable to any training environment. It's got limited kit and also only takes around about 45 minutes to do each session. So check out the link in the description. This question is around contrast and complex training. At which point in a 10-week fight camp would you look to implement contrast or complex training? Now, this is a fantastic transition from the last question when I'm talking about when we'd put in explosive training into a 10-week or 12-week program. Now, with complex or contrast training, this is fantastic for athletes that maybe need to work on their maximum strength and keep topping up them levels, but also want to work on their strength speed at the right time. So with complex training, it allows us to work on max strength and maximum force outputs later on in the training camp. So you'd look to start this around about 7 or 6 weeks out from fight night. You can even finish this around about 2 or 3 weeks out from fight night. So it's allowing you to take that maximum strength training in the strength speed format later on into the camp. So that's where you'd place it within a training camp. Whether you want to do it up to 2 weeks before you fight or 4 weeks before you fight, it's totally up to you. But what I would say is that you need to change your exercise selection depending on where you're stopping the training block. So if you're doing it from 4 weeks out and you're finishing your complex or contrast training 4 weeks out from a fight, you can use your traditional preloading exercise. So your heavy lifts, trap bar from blocks, your box squats, Anderson squats. These are still useful exercises to use. However, if you're taking contrast or complex training towards later in the training camp, so nearer towards your fight, then I'd look to try and use isometrics. So stuff like the trap bar in a split stance or doing like isometric hip thrust, pairing this up with a box jump or counter movement jump. Even though these are heavy lifts and doing it for a short amount of reps, it's still got high neuromuscular outputs, neuromuscular fatigue that's associated with that. But also you've got eccentric loading, can end up leaving an athlete quite sore especially in the vital parts of training camp, where they're going to have intense sparring and increased boxing training loads. You might not get the maximum output required on your maximum strength lifts because they're on a reduced calories, so they've got increased energy deficit. Their performance on the strength lifts will be reduced, but also the rest that they need from them heavy lifts will be increase as well. So that might affect the potentiating factors going into the jump. So it meant that this training phase less effective. So doing the isometrics, these are less challenging, less fatiguing, still carry the potentiating factors to increase performance on your jumps. Just to summarize, contrast a complex training, use it from 7 to 6 weeks out through to 4 to 2 weeks out. But the later that you leave it, I'd change the heavy lifts, such as your trap bar and your squats. Change that to some isometrics, ideally the split stance trap bar lift or your isometric hip thrust, and pairing that up with a lighter load and explosive movement. So interesting question here around about intensity of strength training. How intense should we do our strength training and what RPE should we do it at? I mean, should we train to failure or how close should it be? And what about drop sets, etc.? What you've given me here is a range of different questions, a range of different situations. General rule of thumb for the RPE of strength training for boxing should be around about 8 out of 10. We're not wanting to go to failure every single time because we're wanting to leave reps in the tank. With strength training, we want the adaptations, but we're not wanting the fatigue that's associated with that. We recognize at Boxing Science that strength training is really important, but also the list of priorities is behind boxing training, sparring, pad work, also your conditioning as well. So with strength training, we don't want to max that out to then have an effect on performance and the more important areas in your training. So general rule of thumb is around about 8 out of 10 RPE. You want to be leaving around about 2 or 3 reps in the tank. And this is really important when we're doing maximum strength training, where we do velocity targets, where we know the lowest velocity that each athlete needs to perform at. So we know when they're actually fatigued. And we're also looking at velocity drop-off as well. So we're not wanting anything more than 10 or 15% velocity drop-off. We know that they're getting quite fatigued from this. But if you don't have access to velocity-based training device, you can just use RPE as an example. So 8 out of 10 is perfect. I also asked the question around about drop sets. Now that is a total different ball game. We're looking for muscular hypertrophy, strength endurance, and you're looking for there a 9, 9.5, maybe even 10 out of 10 RPE. You're working towards failure on your drop sets because that is what's going to stimulate the targeted adaptation, muscular hypertrophy. So RPE is a fantastic tool to use, but you've just got to make sure that it's applicable to each exercise. Rule of thumb is around about 8 out of 10 for your strength training. When you drop to more explosive training, looking around about 5 or 6 out of 10. But if you're looking for muscular hypertrophy adaptations, looking for around about a 9 or 10 out of 10 effort. Question around ankle strengthening and mobility drills for boxing. We attack this in a few different ways. We look to mobilize, stabilize, and strengthen. On mobilizing, we're looking to increase that range of motion of the ankle. So you're looking for like that knee going over toe with the heel planted. And a range of different ways that you can do this. You can do it on the floor, kneeling, pushing that knee over the standing foot. You can do this banded floss, so going around the ankle and really working that range. For stability, looking at low intensity plyometrics, low pogos, single leg pogo switches, and also we're looking at like slaloms as well. This is building up the reactive element around the foot complex that can protect the ankles and also the Achilles tendon as well. And then to strengthen, we're looking at isometrics mainly. So we can do like low level isometrics, which is around about 10, 20 second holds, which is purely body weight. And this will strengthen the calf muscles, which will help protect the ankle complex and the Achilles tendon. But mainly what we do at Boxing Science is we use isometrics, overcoming isometrics, where we're pushing against an immovable object, and we'll do either double leg, single leg, or single leg switches. We also use a weighing scale, which gives us some feedback on the amount of force that an athlete can produce. And we found that people with a stronger calf complexes can produce a most amount of force there, and that will really protect that foot complex, ankle complex, and also the Achilles tendon from injury. But will also help increase performance around reactive strength and your plyometrics as well. So I've got a fantastic question here. how to build rotational power for boxing. This is a fantastic question. It's a very, very important area because rotational power does have a huge transfer towards punching power. A lot of boxers, athletes, and coaches all can recognize the benefits. That's why they look to try and do rotational med ball throws, rotational med ball slams. But the biggest mistake is that athletes and coaches look to try and do this first because this has the biggest transfer towards the punch and looks more like explosive performance. However, due to mobility issues and strength issues, boxers should work on the foundations first before moving on to these powerful and explosive exercises. The foundations are mobility, stability, and strength. So we look at mobility first. So we're looking at improving the mobility of the thoracic region of the spine, which is your upper back. A lot of boxers get tight in here because they're tight in their shoulders and it's very arm dominant sport, anterior dominant sport. So they get tight in the thoracic spine, which will affect their thoracic rotation, which means that they'll start compensating through that rotation through either side bending or kind of extension of the spine. And this makes the back muscles quite tight, in particular the QL muscle, the quadratus lumborum, and this affects rotational performance. So with this, we look to try and focus on improving that thoracic rotation and also upper body and lower body separation, which is keeping the legs stable whilst improving that upper body rotation. We look to also improve rotational stability. This is anti-rotation. So we're resisting rotation. Basically, we're performing the core movements that require very little or no rotation of the spine. This is where we're doing pull-off presses, isometric pull-off presses, and a range of different rotational exercises that keeping that resistance fixed all the way through. This is really important to transfer towards rotational performance because we need that stiffness to control the eccentric loading going through the stretch shortening cycle when we're performing powerful rotational movements. And then before we move on to rotational power, we transfer that stability into strength, where we're working rotational strength through a range of motion. This is still anti-rotation because we're still controlling that rotation, but we're going through a range of motion. And we're particularly concentrating on the eccentric portion of this because, like I said, the eccentric is important to controlling forces during the stretch shortening cycle to then reproduce force into powerful rotational performance. And this should give you the right foundations in terms of strength and stability, but also the mobility in there to make sure that you've got the right activation patterns to get the most out of your rotational power exercises. Then when you're doing your rotational power exercises, you need to make sure that you're going towards the four different elements that we're wanting to do. Wanting to overload the eccentric. So making sure that we're providing enough force going into that med ball throw to overload that eccentric to then reproduce power through that stretch shortening cycle. We need to make sure that we're pivoting and not leaning. A key mistake that we see boxers do when they're looking to try and produce force, they're leaning into that movement. So this means that they're not using that rotational function, they're more kind of using that QL and also using the body weight as momentum to generate that power. Then also you're needing to make sure that you're doing upper body and lower body separation. So making sure you're keeping them legs fixed, creating that coil effect through the trunk. So the more that the legs move, the less kind of strain that you have on the oblique muscles and your trunk muscles. And then we're moving away from that adaptation that we're wanting to create. If you're wanting to move your hips into the movement, make sure that you're pivoting your hips all the way through and we're not having them hips in no man's land. Then the fourth one is making sure that you're not underloading the movement, not making sure that you're doing it light on 3 kilos or 2 kilo medicine balls. Make sure that you're getting the right loading for your athletes. So with lighter fighters, you would be going around about 3 or 5 kilos. For heavier fighters, I class that as light middleweight and above, you're working towards around about 5 or 7 kilos on your rotational med ball work.
So we've got a question here on how to get fit quick. From all the different types of training that we do here at Boxing Science, the type of training that we think offers the greatest benefit in the shortest amount of time is muscle buffer training. Now, the idea of muscle buffer training is to increase the level of muscular acidosis so that it's moderately high. And accompanying that, you'll also get a good deal of stimulus on the cardiac system as well. The adaptations to muscle buffer training are relatively quick, and you know, we can see some good adaptations within 3 to 4 weeks. The advantage of this type of training is that you're running at a high intensity, so you also get a good deal of neuromuscular load, so you're producing high forces by running pretty quickly, and that gives you an overall good training effect and training stimulus. So the two classic sessions that we do at Boxing Science are a 2 minute interval. If you're thinking about the effort that you need to run at, it's around about 7 or 8 out of 10. So fast, but not too fast. So that's 2 minutes of very hard running with 2 to 3 minutes recovery in between. And you're looking to do anywhere between 6 and 8 reps of those 2 minute intervals. Another way you can do it is to make the running part very, very short. So around about 12 seconds with around about 48 seconds recovery. I mean, you can even go to 15 and 45. And the idea there is to almost sprint. And so you'll be hitting around about 90% of maximum sprint speed before then having a little bit of passive recovery. So resting, doing nothing, or light walking. And you probably want to be hitting around about 15 to 20 repetitions of those 12 to 15 second intervals. Question about how to recover well on a low budget. The things that you need to be looking at here, first of all, is you almost need to be taking a step back and looking at the training that you're doing within a week, and then looking at that training that you're doing within the day. Is it sensible? Is the distribution of training sensible? Are you doing your conditioning sessions at the same within the same day as boxing sessions or strength? And is that periodization correct? You don't want to be adding fatigue where you can manage your week a little bit better. So take a look at your week and just make sure it's planned appropriately. Then think about food. Think about fluid. These are all basic, low-cost things that, you know, you don't need fancy equipment to look at. So are you replacing fluid after each session? Do you know how much you're sweating? If you don't, weigh yourself before and after training and look at that amount of fluid that you're losing. Replace 150% of that. So replace your fluid and then the extra bit, which is half of that. Make sure you're getting your recovery in. Make sure you're eating plenty of carbohydrates. You're fueling before exercise. You're making sure that you're having 20 to 30 grams of protein every 2 to 3 hours throughout the day. And just making sure that you've got those basic elements of the week set up first. So you're thinking about your fluid, your food, and your programming. Then think about your sleep. Sleep costs nothing. We all need to do it. Make sure that you've got a good sleep routine. Go into sleep consistently. You're waking up consistently as well at the same time. You're having almost a decompression period before you go to bed. Your body temperature's dropping and your room is not too hot. Optimum room temperature is somewhere around about 18 degrees Celsius. Making sure you're relaxing, putting your devices away, giving yourself some time away from the screen, trying not to fall asleep as you're scrolling through things. They're all really good tips as well. So you're looking at sleep, you're looking at distributing your training, food, and fluid. At the end of your training sessions, thinking about cool down, thinking about mobility. Those are the things that you should think about recovery. It's really, really basic things, recovery on a budget. Okay, got a question about sleeping during the day. This can be helpful for some and not for others. What I would think about, first of all, is something called your chronotype. Are you somebody who stays up late? Or are you somebody who likes to get up early? Because that will influence when you sleep and the duration of your sleep as well. If you're a evening person, you perhaps struggle to get to sleep and that's a little bit of a battle for you, it's probably best not to sleep during the day. When you sleep at nighttime, that is going to be where you're going to get the bulk of your sleep within that day. And that's where a lot of the recovery process is going to take place. And so you need to protect that as much as possible. So if you're a night owl and you do struggle to get to sleep, napping is probably not a good idea. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. Make the decision very, very carefully. If you're a morning person, yeah, you might benefit from a nap. So if you get up early, you know, you're talking 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, and then you've got an early morning training session, you might be finished by 9 or 10, and then your next training session is later in the afternoon. Yeah, you might benefit from a nap because you're getting up early. That will also relate to what time you go to sleep as well and whether or not you're getting enough. And generally, you'll need minimum for an athlete 7.5 hours sleep. If you train really hard, you know, you're probably going to push that up to 9 or 10 hours. How long should you nap for? You don't want to be falling into a deeper sleep cycle. Really, you don't want to be napping for an hour because that is going to disrupt some of your sleep rhythms. You really want to try and limit that nap to around about 30 minutes. And there are some research where even, you know, you're napping or you're just resting, trying to fall asleep for 10, 15 minutes is that's going to be really beneficial for your performance, mental performance, physical performance later on in the day. But perhaps a longer duration of sleep, you can wake up a little bit groggy, feeling a little bit unwell, and perhaps it's suppressing your appetite just because you're starting to fall into a deeper sleep stage and we're not used to waking up in deeper sleep. You know, we're used to waking up in light sleep, and so try and keep to that kind of duration. You could also have naps whereby you're taking or having like an espresso or a shot of caffeine just before you then fall asleep, so that by the time that you're waking up out of this sleep stage, you're going to have a hit of caffeine, and that's going to help you wake up and get back going if you feel it's a little bit of struggle after a nap. But like a lot of things, is individual specific, and what works for somebody might not work for somebody else. And as always, we say try and experiment with different things and find what works for you. So we've got a question about sprint interval training. This particular athlete is struggling with holding intensity towards the end of a 30-second sprint and he's dropping way below standards. So this is actually quite common. What we can do in this specific scenario is we can cluster the sprint interval training. So instead of doing a block of 30 seconds, we can cluster it up into 3x10 second intervals with a 10 second recovery period, or we can cluster it into 20 seconds. So we can have a 20 seconds on, 20 seconds off, and 20 seconds on. Do that for a training phase and then revisit it towards the end of the training phase. So we might do a block, a week of 10 seconds, a week of 20 seconds. So we're talking about around about 6 sessions or so there, and then revisit the 30 second intervals and just see if that power has been maintained towards the end of the interval. The advantage of clustering is that you're still going to get a similar physiological response and you're still going to get those adaptive signals that will help your fitness, but it just helps you to maintain that neuromuscular output. And that just has a beneficial effect on the things that are actually limiting physiology, which is force production in this particular case. So it just helps to preserve force and power. And then we can go and really stress that in a 30-second interval a few sessions later. So we've got a question about how to condition a heavyweight. So there are a few things that we've got to consider regarding conditioning for heavyweights. The first thing is their body mass. These are really big guys, a lot of forces going through and a lot of impact forces as well, especially when they're running. So we've got to think about the mode of exercise and choose this carefully. We use the air bike a lot for heavyweights because we can get that whole body activation with a limited load. So we're protecting joints and ligaments and tendons from those high forces that we would have to expose them to if we were performing high intensity training with them on the road or on the treadmill and even on the curve. So the mode that we use is the air bike. Heavyweights also produce a lot of force, and accompanying that a lot of force is muscular acidosis. So heavyweights have got to be able to buffer that acidosis. So we need to have a focus on muscle buffer training to shuttle out the hydrogen ions that are causing acidosis. That's the principal cause. And so muscle buffer training will help us to do this. And then we need to ensure that the heavyweights are able to produce force and power over prolonged time periods, over, you know, 30 second efforts. And in order to help them prepare to do that, we'll use various forms of sprint interval training, 30-second sprint interval training, and clustered forms as that to accompany the muscle buffer training. So it's all very high intensity, very high force, but respecting the impact forces and using the air bike to do that.
Okay, guys, thank you very much for watching or listening to the Boxing Science podcast. Really appreciate your support and the questions asked on this podcast. If you've got any more questions that you want us to cover in the next Q&A episode, leave it in the comment box below. And then if you have any suggestions or reviews or feedback about the podcast, leave that in the comment box or the review section on Apple or Spotify. Last but not least, if you can hit the like button or give us a rating, that'd be much appreciated. Putting a lot of time into delivering this content for you, so a little bit of feedback for us will help the podcast and the YouTube channel grow, and we can do way more content. Hopefully soon we're going to have a studio, so we're going to have guests coming in doing way more quality content. So thank you very much for watching and listening. Hopefully see you on the next episode of the Boxing Science podcast.